Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource for Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here as always with my friend and my colleague and my co-host, Dr. Ronnie Kurtz, assistant professor of systematic theology.
You got it.
All right.
Yeah, you got it, man.
Good deal. We were just talking about what a great idea it would be if we had some kind of pageant at Midwestern.
You're using the word great there pretty loosely.
Well, I thought it was great. You kind of looked at me like a dog looks at somebody when they're talking, trying to figure out, like, what does this mean? Not a beauty pageant.
Yeah.
We could do that, I guess, but come on, you know. But a pageant of, like, who's the smartest or nerdiest theologian? And so you get all these guys who want to compete to kind of walk up on stage, and you kind of walk down the line, and you test them with certain questions. You know, like in the Miss America stuff, they always have the questions. How would you solve world peace and those sorts of things?
Yeah.
We could do that with our guys and just have, like, rapid fire theological questions, and guys could represent their state or their city. Mr.
Jared.
Oklahoma.
I
what is your response to Jonathan Edwards's scrupulosity?
Yeah. You
know, something like that.
I don't have words to convey how much I hate this idea.
Really?
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah.
But the one good thing, or is it
all,
like,
of
what
it?
Is
the
it,
showmanship, the platforming, the attention.
Yeah.
What the one good thing about this idea is, you said we could get guys who want to compete, you know, in this.
Yeah, yeah.
The one good idea is that would put it would get all of the people who I know I'm not going to be friends with in one place.
Okay.
Because anyone who would want to compete in something like that is probably someone I'm not going to hang out with.
This is a different environment, isn't it? Like, you walk down the halls and you just hear these two guys walking by just casually.
Yeah.
And they're talking about, you know, supralapsarianism or something. And it's like, you don't hear this anywhere else.
Yeah.
And I thought, let's just have a Hunger Games style question and answer to figure out who is the top dog. Because, you know, if there's one thing that young men love to do, it's to size each other up and to compete. And in this environment, we were going to find out who's the real top dog.
I literally have theologian. Like all of my classes start with a lecture exactly against this.
It can have a sash. You wear a sash that's like Mr.
I feel more
Mr.
comfortable.
Theology 2025.
I feel more comfortable talking about UFOs.
Okay. Well,
time for one of those famous Jared transitions.
Well,
you know?
I was trying to think of the transition as like you're asking questions of these contestants in the pageant.
Okay.
And it's a mailbag episode.
Wait, does that mean we're the contestants?
Maybe
if we're doing a mailbag episode?
I think you should have no problem in a pageant because you have zero notes. You basically walked up and said, I don't have anything. I'm just going to freestyle it. And I thought, only a smart guy or someone... Or someone who thinks
who
they're
perceives
smart,
themselves, yes,
would approach the topic that
way.
I, on the other hand, have to have some notes here so I can remember.
To each his own. I have some notes.
Okay. You have the ultimate note.
That's right.
Well, this comes from Ralton on Facebook. Ralton says, with the recent seeming resurgence of young men interested in the church and in things of faith, what recommendations or suggestions do you have in order for churches to engage them in a way to keep them gospel focused? Great question, Ralton on Facebook. I've actually thought quite a bit about this myself.
Then start us off.
You want me to start off? Yeah. Well, we have at Liberty Baptist Church, we have seen a resurgence of young men.
Yeah.
We've had good number of young men in our church for the last 10 years, you know, as long as I've been there. But we've begun to see, young men maybe from unchurched backgrounds or who are maybe what we would call de-churched. Teenage guys, mm-hmm. sometimes with even from unbelieving families and mm-hmm. things like that. Guys bringing their, you know, girlfriends and
yep.
I mean, we've seen, in a representative way, but you know, perhaps a small way, what seems to be a larger trend, which is there are more and more younger men, Gen Z, who are going back to church.
Yeah.
The question we have to ask ourselves is why are they doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And the speculation, I think, has been, this is part of a political resurgence of political conservatism among young men. I think there's likely overlap that makes sense that conservatives are religious, and if you see by and large, and if you see, or at least more interested in religion, a resurgence in conservatism among young men. You would see a resurgence of religion in young men. But I think it's in some ways what we hope that they're looking for is a search for meaning.
Mm-hmm.
The meaning for their life, what kind of ambition should I be about? Ralton's question is really, I think, a helpful directive for us to not just enjoy that young men are showing up, but to think of this as a stewardship.
Yes.
How do we keep them gospel focused?
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of chatter online about how we've got to keep these young men by feeding them the kind of political mm-hmm. red meat, because that's why they're coming. I don't perceive that that's why they're coming. They may enjoy that. That may resonate with them. But to Ralton's point, I think the number one thing that we have to show them, aside from biblical preaching, expository preaching, in the gathering, et cetera, but is in the community, older men who are following Jesus, who can serve as spiritual fathers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as Paul, you know, wrote to the church, you've had many guides in the faith, but few fathers.
Yes.
And I think just as important as these guys showing up and hearing expository preaching that culminates in Jesus Christ is to see spiritual fathers in the church, that there are disciplers, that we're not content to just serve as sort of an attractional repository for young men who are interested in Christianity now or religion mm-hmm. now, but that we actually are prepared to show them what it looks like to be a godly husband and a godly father and a godly employee and all those sorts of things, which does not seem to me, an overarching concern when I look at how to steward young men online.
Yes.
Right.
That's so, exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with every word of that. That's exactly how I feel. There is, we see it at Emmaus as well. There is a increase in young men coming to church, Gen Z, and even getting into Gen Alpha at this point. You know, there is a uptick there. And that is encouraging. The church has been so predominantly female in terms of attendance for the last, I don't know, you could probably speak to that better than I could.
Yeah.
But there's that old trope that on Mother's Day, when the moms get to decide what the family does, they go to church.
It's high attendance day.
That's high attendance day.
Yeah.
But on Father's Day, they're at the lake or something, you know. Right. And so we're seeing a little bit of that reverse, which is encouraging.
Yes.
We need masculinity in the church. And I think to the question, I think you're exactly right. We don't want to continue stoking that, like, they need red meat, they have to have, you know, politics is what's driving their faith. And yet, I do think on the other side of that, there is a sense in which they can see, even in something like conservatism, a call towards a different kind of manliness or yeah. manhood
yeah.
that the world has just not valued for a while. Men have gotten more and more effeminate in a lot
yeah,
of ways.
Yeah.
And they see in a conservative worldview that we actually think there's something to conserve about the way men have acted in the past. And I don't want to continue to win them with politics, because as you've said many times, what you win people with, you win them too.
Yeah.
And I don't merely want to win people to conservative politics. I want to win people to Christ. And so I don't want to continue stoking that. However, I am inclined to stoke that inward feeling they have towards something more meaningful, something greater, something more masculine, more deep. Now, what they'll need to see is that sometimes masculinity looks like dying to yourself for the sake of others. And what masculinity doesn't always have to look like is this war that I'm always waging, and there's like this overt macho-ness, but sometimes it looks like gentleness and meekness. Now, there are times where they'll need to step up in those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But I do think calling them to something deeper, intellectually, disciplines, Bible study, church attendance, you know, dying to themselves for the sake of others, I think that's good and right, and something that we see men desiring, of like, call them to a higher standard.
Yeah.
With the gospel, of course, but call them to a higher standard of living. And what I'm seeing is young men responding well to that.
Yeah. Ralton, to your question, like, how do you keep them gospel focused? Is you have a community that's focused on the gospel.
That's right.
And that can be shaping and forming. But I think if you've got the two-pronged approach of, you know, gospel-centered content, so that your services are shaped by the gospel, and that's kind of the primary shaping, you know, arena. But then you have a community that is providing discipleship, that's, you know, providing spiritual fatherhood, that's providing examples of families and other couples and friendships, a brotherhood that is aimed at you know, the good news of Jesus and being informed by that. That's going to have,
yes,
you know, formative influence over time as well. This comes from Bob on Twitter. Bob is has a question specific to the both of us. I think he says, specific to the two of you, how do you manage your busy schedules, preaching, teaching, writing, and more without burning out?
Still figuring it out, Bob.
I'm going to be honest and say I get this question a lot.
Yeah.
Or a variation of it, which is like, how do you balance everything, or how do you keep, you know, how do you do everything?
Yeah.
Because I do a lot, and I do acknowledge that I do a lot, but I don't like the question because I don't think that my you know, my setup is normative or normal.
Yeah.
I don't know how translatable it is to say,
yeah,
I'm not a full-time pastor, and I know Bob is, or I think Bob is. I think I know who this Bob is. But if, you know, I don't have full-time hours, so it's pretty flexible. Mm-hmm. I don't have an office of the church. We're both in academia, so we teach. That has, you know, requirements of, mm-hmm, being on campus at certain times or whatever, but I don't have, it's not an 8-to-5 job.
That's right.
So I have a flexibility with my quote unquote full-time job. I travel and speak, but I'm able to say, I don't want to go there, or can I go there, or what, you know, I mean, so all the, you know, various streams of things I do, it has just a lot of flexibility to it.
Yeah.
And so
why don't, maybe we, for the sake of the question and helpfulness, maybe we can focus on what is transferable.
Okay.
So like, for example,
you said specific to us, so.
That's true. You're right. Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I'm being specific to me.
That's true. Okay. Yeah. Well, specific to me, that is still transferable.
Okay. All right.
Two things I would say as I've, you know, gotten a little bit older. I think I used to think that I was good at this.
Okay.
But I learned that I was more optimistic than I should have been. Hmm. Even recently, my wife approached me and was like, "We would love a little more time, you know." And I think if you are married, that's your barometer.
Okay.
Your wife and your children. You might think you're crushing it.
Yeah.
But let them be the temperature, you know, thermostat there. And even if you think you're doing well, I would just listen to that. You know, that is who you should be listening to. On the other hand, I do think there's a transferability in this, in that I have learned myself in my rhythms. For example, and I'm able to do this because of my job, so this is unique. Bob might not be able to do this, but I write fairly well from about 6 a.m. to noon. And I write quite poorly from like 1 p.m. to 4 p.m.
Okay.
And I've learned that.
I think I'm the opposite.
Really?
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a harder time getting into a state of like deep work or flow state or whatever you want to call it from 1 to 4. So I have scheduled all of my meetings from 1 to 4. I schedule all of my classes from 1 to 4. Any like one-on-one discipleship, I do at 1 to 4. Because in those things, I often don't need to be in like a deep mode.
Yeah.
Like for sustained periods. But from like 6 to lunch, that's where I can hit it.
Yeah.
And I can get in a state of deep work at 6 a.m. that I can maintain till 10. And that's really helpful. I also was helped by, I don't like everything he says, but I think his name is Oliver. I can't remember his last name, but he wrote the book 4,000 Weeks.
Okay.
A Mortal's Guide to Time Management. And he basically is like, let's press into the fact that we're limited.
Yeah.
As far as I know, he's not a Christian. But he talked about how you're kind of kidding yourself if you think you're going to hit a state of deep work longer than 4 hours. And that actually allowed me to release some probably not realistic expectations,
yeah,
that I had on myself of like, I'm gonna write from 8 to 5. It's like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
You know, you might, but it's going to, yeah, be quite poor in certain areas.
Yeah.
So I write better with long periods of time than like 45 minutes there, 45 minutes here.
Same.
So I try to do like what's a good 4-hour block for the day and hit a word count or do something productive. And if I don't do more than those 4 hours, that's good. That's a good writing day for me.
Yeah, I used to be able to, as a younger man, but specifically with writing, could write all day, take a break, would write well into the night. And now I just find, I don't know if I just don't have the energy for that, or I don't have the mental focus. I think it's an age thing. I'm not sure. But I find it where, like, I come to the end and I think, that's what I've got today.
Yeah.
I just don't think pressing beyond that
is
going to, you know, it'd be more fruitful for me to wait and come at this section tomorrow or something like that. But I'm the opposite. Like, it takes me a while to wake up. So even if I get up early, I'm usually not all there mentally for another hour or so, you know? And so the kind of early morning stuff, I usually like to be like pre-thinking. So things that are brewing in my head before, and then it's into the afternoon, or maybe mid-morning is probably better, but into the afternoon that I can, you know, really kind of get a flow going.
Some traction.
Yeah, you know, when I was a full-time pastor, this is more along kind of what you were saying that might be transferable to Bob, I'm not sure. But I themed my days.
Yeah.
I was thinking of like my capacity in terms of what being, you know, the social, I guess, exhaustion, I guess. And so Mondays I would be admin days, and Tuesdays would be counseling, discipleship days, and visitation days, and Wednesdays would be sermon prep days, and Thursdays would be fun meeting days, you know, discipleship and those sorts of things, meeting with other pastors. And that was helpful to me. But I think, you know, maintaining a day off, so even in my busy schedule now, the reason why it's hard for me and not transferable perhaps is because for me, like, weeks are so different.
Yeah.
You know, I usually have the tent poles of I'm preaching Sunday morning. If I have a residential class, I'm teaching on a Thursday morning or a Tuesday morning or something like that. And so I have those things to work around, but my schedule could be different week to week. I'm out of town 1 week and not the next week and all those sorts of things. But it's important for me to say there's at least one day a week I'm doing nothing.
Yeah.
So maintaining that kind of rhythm of Sabbath, whether you're a strict Sabbatarian or not, but just it's a good, healthy pattern to, you know, work several days and not work one day, and then work several days and not work one day. So having those breaks is really, I think helpful. All right, this comes from Bobby on Facebook.
From Bobby. Bob to Bobby.
Yeah, Bob to Bobby. Bobby says, some churches use a pastoral model where there is no lead pastor and the elders rotate preaching regularly, sometimes weekly, sometimes monthly, etc. Can you discuss the potential benefits and negative aspects of this model?
So not the benefits and cons of being elder-led or not.
Yeah, no, it's the idea like there's no lead pastor.
Okay, more of so a we are elder-led, team. But there's not a,
yeah,
you know, first among equals kind of a thing.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, what I find interesting about the question, because Liberty Baptist Church does not have a lead pastor. We have a shared pastoral model, but we do not have the pastors rotating regularly. So I would be the primary preacher.
Yeah.
I don't know if you'd call that the lead preacher or something like that. So I'm doing most of the preaching. We're not in a regular rotation, but we do not have a lead pastor, so to speak. But we did have, you know, in the interim between, but so we had a lead pastor in the time between that and our and what we have today. We were without a lead pastor, and we did have elders rotating through where you could come. Literally, you could come 5 weeks in a row and hear five different preachers.
Yeah.
I would say the one drawback, and I'll hand it over to you to speak, the one drawback that, you know, for that that I can think of is it was just hard to, in some ways, build momentum.
Yeah.
I think there's a benefit to it, the theoretical benefit, at least for us, because we continued to grow even during that period. And I remember asking you know, prospective members and membership interviews, like, don't you want to wait till we hire a lead pastor? Like, don't you want to wait till we hire, like, the guy who's going to be preaching every week? Because you don't know who's going to be preaching every week.
That's right.
We know this is a temporary thing where every week is a different preacher. And they said, no, like, we love the church, the community. And it told us that people were one to a kind of preaching, not to a particular preacher. I think that can be really healthy. We still thought the benefits of having a primary preacher outweigh the potential drawbacks there. And I just think a consistency in voice kind of helps you build some momentum, some leadership momentum, even in terms of, you know, growth of the church and having a consistency of tone and those sorts of things. I think that can be helpfully, formative, I guess.
Yes.
For the church.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think there's like a thou must do this.
Yeah.
Now, I do believe in a plurality of eldership, of course. That's my ecclesial conviction. A couple of things I would say, pro and con, like even for you guys, you might not be the first amongst equals, but I'm interested in even how you would respond to the idea that, like, by gravity, whoever is in the pulpit is the lead guy in the eyes of the congregation.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little bit of like, that's my preacher, that's my pastor, you know.
I'm sure there are some who kind of feel that way and mm-hmm. think that way. And I see it, but I see it more from newer people.
Yeah.
Who they either assume, oh, because I'm the one who's been preaching the last 4 weeks that they've attended, I must be the lead pastor. Or
yeah.
Sometimes that they'll makes say sense. The pastor.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
they're
yeah.
from a, you know, that's church right. background that has the pastor. And I'll have to say, well, I'm one of the pastors, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing. And there are maybe newer folks who I think because I'm the most visible pastor by virtue of that, they may think that. But I think for our community, to be honest with you, if they think that we have a lead pastor, and I sometimes say this like jokingly, it's Pastor Bobby at yeah. our church.
The one who asked the question.
Different
just
Bobby.
Kidding.
Oh, maybe
just kidding.
It's the same Bobby, though.
He's like, am I?
Yeah, Pastor Bobby's actually not on Facebook. He's not on social media at all,
yeah.
which is probably very wise for him. But he kind of serves, we would almost say, like, in a lot of churches, like the executive pastor kind of role.
Okay.
So he manages staff. He is the chair of the elder team. He agendas the meetings, those sorts of things. He kind of runs point. He's one of only two full-time pastors we have anyway.
Yeah.
But he's kind of running in that role. The only thing that, you know, is not typical of a lead pastor or that is typical of a lead pastor that he doesn't do is the preaching.
Yeah.
But he's doing everything else. So it's yep. almost like, I think people recognize, oh, Bob, you know, I hear from Bobby more than Jared. And
yeah.
I hear from, you know, yeah. he's running communication and mm-hmm. in members meetings, he's speaking more mm-hmm. and those sorts of things.
That makes sense.
So I think for our community, though,
I
think at least for us,
okay.
they don't look at me as
yeah.
the lead
okay.
pastor, I don't think.
Yeah, I think the other pros and cons, like the pro of having one person relatively consistent. I actually don't think it should be like a 52 weeks, there's a person.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
might actually be unhealthy in other ways.
I think that's unhealthy. Yeah.
But you know, if you're like 35, 40 weeks of the year, I'm the guy preaching. I think there's a couple of things that are pros and then a couple of things that are cons. The pro is people learn to listen to that person. You know, I had a pastor once who wasn't the most like captivating preacher in the world in terms of like his persona and his delivery. He just wasn't like that kind of orator.
Yeah.
But he had these like lines that were penetrating to the soul. And I learned to listen for them because I heard his preaching regularly. So like my diet of how to listen to a sermon changed by virtue of getting regular consistency with this guy in the pulpit. You might not get that as much where you're like, oh, you're kind of constantly changing your listening habits with other people. The other pro, I think, as the preacher is the studying. It's actually kind of hard for me. Like, you know, let's say you're doing a book. I remember we at Emmaus once we preached two sermons through each of the prophets. So it was like this overarching, it wasn't like exegetical. We focused on God's grace and God's grandeur in each of the prophets.
Okay.
So it was like semi-topical, semi-expository, and it was our way of just trying to get some of the prophets in the diet of the church. And what was really hard about that series is every other week you're trying to wrap your head around the context of a new biblical book. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that historical, grammatical background studying for the sermon got like really tiring. Whereas like if you're in Romans for the next 2 years,
yeah.
you get Romans in your rhythm, in your head, and then you can exegete the text a little easier. So that if you have like a constant rotation, it's like you might preach Romans 1 and then Romans 8 and then Romans 14. And you're like, you don't really have the flow in your head.
Yeah, I got you.
The way that you might if you're the primary preacher throughout the book of Romans.
Yeah.
I even know churches, I don't recommend this, but I know churches where because of that, they'll have like different series going with different preachers. Like this guy, when he preaches, we're doing Mark. When he preaches, we're doing Matthew, you know. Now, the pro is what you've mentioned, the pro of having like a multiple or maybe the con of having a single person.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that like reliance on a personality, reliance on a style, that kind of thing. And just it's good for men to get reps, you know.
Yes.
Able to teach is one of the qualifications of elder.
That would be one of the final things that I would throw in as a benefit.
That's right.
You get guys who rarely have the opportunity to exercise or grow in their in their ability to
teach. Yes, that's exactly right.
And they get those reps. Yep. Yeah. And I just think it's good for a church to hear from her pastors.
Yes.
If you've got multiple elders, even if it's not in the pulpit, you know, are there other ways to have? So we have, you know, the service leader component.
Yep.
So the guy who's doing the welcome and the past in our church, the fellow who is doing the welcome and call to worship and a pastoral prayer or corporate prayer. And the announcements at the end is usually the same guy.
Yep.
And it's often a pastor. Oh, yeah. It's not always a pastor, but it often is. And then we have Pastor Paul, who is the normally the guy who leads us in the worship service or the singing. And he is leading us in liturgy and those things as well. So, and then you have the preacher, who's usually me. So you usually have three kind of upfront pastoral you know, visibilities, I guess, in the service. I think that is really helpful.
Yes.
In members meetings, we're rotating through. Yep. We send the agenda out. There's currently four of us pastors. We send the agenda out to each other. Okay, who's going to do this? Who's going to do that? Who's going to do this? So that we're having a good visibility. I just think that's healthy for a church to see who her pastors are. Some guys will have to be more in the background than others, and just either by gifting or personality or the role that they're fulfilling. But as much as you can, you know, even if it's not in the pulpit, Bobby, I just think it's good to have your pastors in front of the church.
That's right.
So that they, can have a growing familiarity with them. All right, we spent a lot. We could have done a whole episode probably.
I know,
This comes from Ed on Twitter. Ed says, how do you cultivate humility within yourself while possessing a high theological education? Maybe you win that pageant, you know. How do you cultivate humility within yourself while possessing a high theological education, particularly a D-min or PhD in ministry, to your church family? Do they call you doctor or not?
Hmm.
Should anybody care? Why or why not? This comes from Dr. Ed Romine, actually.
Oh, nice.
So that's the Ed.
Yeah, I love that.
Asking the question.
Yeah.
This is a funny question because, is it C.S. Lewis who said something like humility is the thing that goes away as soon as you start talking about it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes. Yeah.
I'm sure I butchered the quote, but
yeah.
How do you stay humble?
Yeah.
Dr. Kurtz?
Well, yeah.
With
good question, Dr. Wilson.
A high theological education.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously value theological education, something I've given my life to. But what I have found, and I know this isn't the case for everyone, but what I have found is the more that I learn, the more that humility is rooted.
Hmm.
Because, you know, with every door you open theologically, you recognize, oh, there's six more doors in this room, you know. Hmm. And so there's almost this, like, you might have seen this like meme where it's the bell curve of a theological student, where it's like you first get into it and the bell curve starts to rise and you're like, I know a lot. And it gets to the point where you're like, I know everything. And then it peaks and you're starting to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you learn how much you don't learn and you're like, I know nothing. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you get to this pit of despair of like, I thought I knew everything. I actually know nothing, and I'm relatively agnostic about everything. And then eventually you land to, like, I know something, you know?
Yeah.
Wisdom is getting towards, like, I don't know everything. I know something.
That's a good chart of getting older, too.
That's exactly right. Yeah, yes, that's right. And I just, you know, I tell my students all the time, theological wisdom is not microwavable. This is a long game. Theological wisdom often only comes with age and suffering, as we see in the scriptures. And hopefully part of a formal doctoral process or a formal theological education is, you know, you come face to face with the incomprehensible God and you say, who am I? You know, that's when a good theologian starts to spring up. So hopefully the theological process in itself does this for you. Now, there is going to be some, like, you know, semantics and kind of what he's mentioning about, like, does your church call you doctor? You know, we're in a weird context where I would guess 80% of my church knows me as Ronnie, but we're in the unique context where I have students in my church.
Right. Yep.
For them, this is probably the only ones where this question's weird, where it's like, I don't really feel comfortable calling you Ronnie, but it also feels weird calling you Dr. Kurtz, yes. you know, in church. And I'm happy for people to call me Ronnie. I do like, I'm a little bit more old fashioned in terms of like, I like the respectability of offices. And I think there's something lost when we get so casual. There's no distinguishing between, you know, expertise and non. But my personality is going to be bent towards call me Ronnie.
Yes.
So, you know, for me, I had professors. I was their pastor and they were my professor. And out of just, I would rather err on the side of respect. So I, as a student, would call them Dr. So-and-so. But now as the one with the PhD with students in my church, I don't care.
I feel the same way. And in this environment, and I'm a new doctor, so I'm still kind of even adjusting to yeah. some of that as well. In this environment, it would make sense. I would be even introduce myself maybe as Dr. Wilson, or yeah. I would say that, you know. But at the church, I'm Jared, or yeah. I love Pastor Jared.
That's right.
I don't require
Amen.
That anybody call me that. But especially, you know, when the kids,
yep.
you know, call you Pastor Jared, like, yeah, so no requirement. I, you know, I still want my wife to call me Dr.
Yeah,
Dr.
she's not.
Wilson just once.
Not yet.
No. And like, in a scenario, like, I want to be, like, checking into a hotel.
Yeah, yeah.
And like her,
you've
have,
said this, yeah.
And have her say something like, you know, the doctor and I would yeah. like a room on the...
Yeah.
That's all I want.
And she won't do it.
But nobody else. I don't care if anybody else does it or not. Here's my answer to your question, Ed. How do you cultivate humility? Be known.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of what they call you, that's a, you know, whole... You know, it's a related question, but not the central question. How do you cultivate humility? I think you have to be known. Mm-hmm. If you're worried about your image, your reputation, a particular, you know, facade, academically respectable or whatever it is, it's going to be harder to do that. Mm-hmm. You'll be constantly, you know, worrying about your position, how you look, how you come across. But the more you're in community groups and opening up about your life and sharing your testimony, the more you're discipling other, other men, you know, all these scenarios, you know, dinner parties. So tomorrow night, our church has the Lottie Moon chili cook-off, right? And I'm making a chili to compete in the cook-off. And, you know, there's just something about that environment, just being with the family
yeah.
in a potluck.
That's right.
I mean, it's the kind of thing.
No one cares if you have a PhD when you're at a chili kickoff.
Yeah, I mean, you're just Jared there. And you know, I think Ray Ortland once said, you can be impressive or you can be known,
that's
but
right.
you can't be both.
Yep.
And I think he's somewhat wrong in that I find it really impressive people who are willing to be known.
Yes.
Willing to get vulnerable. Yep. That to me is impressive. But I know what he means.
Yes.
From our own perspective, mm-hmm. you can be impressive or you can be known. And I just think we got to opt for being known.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
As much as possible. Okay. This comes from Jared on Facebook. Not me.
You just type your own questions.
Jared says, do you have any tips on how to effectively preach on special occasions such as Christmas or Easter, or at large one-off events? He mentioned someone who recommends preaching without notes on special occasions so as to be more engaging, and asked if we've ever tried this. Any thoughts on effectively preaching on special occasions?
Yeah, I'll be quick here. You can share more if you'd like, but I wouldn't recommend no notes.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
As the guy who's using no notes right now, I would not recommend that.
Well, it just depends on what makes you more engaging.
Yeah.
If you're more engaging without notes, then why wouldn't you always not use notes? I don't
yeah,
understand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I wouldn't say because it's a special occasion, alter your preaching style.
Yes, totally
yeah.
agree.
I would say special occasions are can be really meaningful, and you should be sensitive to that. I think something modern preachers often can lack is they have the ability to exegete a text, but not a people. Hmm. And there is real emotions tied to ceremonial events, whether they're silly or not. You know, Mother's Day means something different
yeah.
to some people, and that's good to be attuned to. I think there are times in which you should probably just keep going with your exegetical sermon series that you're doing and keep expositing the next text. And there are some times when it's totally fine to break from whatever exposition you're doing because of the special ceremony. But you have to be wise in knowing when that is. I would just say the only thing I would change if you're doing like, hey, this is a unique special thing, like, you know, tomorrow night our church does, it's become a tradition. We're a younger church, and so a lot of our people leave on Christmas Eve. And so Christmas Eve services are are pretty low attendance for us because people are going back to their homes.
Yeah.
But we do this new thing called the Eve of the Eve. And it's become like a fun celebration on December 23rd.
Okay.
We have like what most churches would have on a Christmas Eve service. Well, we have that coming up soon, but at the time of this recording. And our pastor, our lead pastor, Tyler, is going to preach the way Tyler preaches, but it'll be a little bit shorter. There'll be more kids in the room. It's just not totally a normal service. So that would be the one thing you might want to change, is like a longer sermon or a shorter sermon. But I would say be you, be faithful, and, you know, preach the word.
Yeah, I mean, the idea isn't that it's so radically different from what you normally do that even if visitors come and enjoy it, they would have a culture shock if they came the next week. And
that's
like,
totally
different.
Yeah.
But I do think being more mindful of visitors, particularly on these holidays.
That's right.
I don't know about large one-off events. If you're thinking of events where there may be visitors, like you know, conferences what we used to call revival meetings or those sorts of things, I totally understand that. But like evangelistic events. But think of Christmas and Easter along those lines as well. You've got people who aren't normally in church, typically in most churches, who will come to church. And so it doesn't need to be radically different from what you normally do. It just needs to be mindful that you have got guests there probably more than usual. To some extent, these are things that I think good preachers are thinking through every week as well. Like, how do I make sure I speak to the unbeliever
in the room?
The worship gathering is not for the unbeliever, but you want to be hospitable. You want to be welcoming. You want to even... you know, evangelistically address certain objections that may come up to the text, anticipate those things, to answer questions. Don't assume that everyone in the room all believes and knows the same thing. And so you want to have in mind the unbeliever or the, immature believer who may need some more handholding. And so at Christmas, Easter, and other holidays, you may have a larger percentage of those folks. So that might mean for their capacity to be most hospitable to them, maybe you preach 5-10 shorter, you know, fewer minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you have more sort of illustrative content that kind of helps you, you know, reinforce your point. Those are the ways to think through being, I think, engaging. But I wouldn't necessarily try to switch up too much, content-wise, so it's radically different than what you do every week. And I certainly, if you're normally a notes preacher and that's working for you, you're at your best when you do that. Like, I know for me, I have to have a manuscript to sound like the best version of me.
Mm-hmm.
So to get rid of that, thinking I'm going to be more engaging.
Yeah.
I it would be so much more unpolished. Mm-hmm. I would be chasing rabbit trails. I'd probably be preaching too long because I used to preach, before manuscript. That's what happened when I preached from notes and outline.
Right.
It was a mess. So, don't do anything that's going to be outside your norm in that way. Okay, final question. This comes from Jason on Twitter. Jason asks, and I'm going to kick this question over to you because you read a lot of fiction. I've not read much fiction this year. That's a shame that I have. But what's been your favorite fiction read of 2025?
Yes. We should just do an annual fiction episode.
Okay.
All right. Like a year in review of fiction.
This year would be a bummer because I've read Fellowship of the Ring. That was a reread. But I was working on my dissertation, a couple of books. I just did not have those.
I will say I read less. I moved this year.
Yeah.
And like selling my house in Ohio, buying a house in Missouri.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it was just I think I always do like a year in review. And I think I read 10 fiction books this year.
Okay,
For me is
quite
low. The one that's sticking out to me is the one I'm finishing right now. It's I got into, and this is wild for me because I'm not a sci-fi guy.
Oh, okay.
Like at all. And this is like low sci-fi, if you can even count it that. But I'm finishing volume 2 in James Islington's Hierarchy series.
Okay.
So the first is called The Will of the Many. The second is called The Strength of the Few. Those books took off on like Goodreads and BookTok and those kinds of things. So they're wildly popular right now. I just saw yesterday Sony announced that they bought the rights to them to make movies. Huh. It's going to be a quadrilogy. It is... the most fun I've had reading a fiction series since like Harry Potter when I was a kid.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's that good.
What's the general premise?
Sci-fi? Yeah, the general premise is it's a low sci-fi, but the general premise, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's kind of an outcast young boy who is rebelling against something he finds to be unethical in his society. And his choice to do so causes him a lot of problems, and he's being thrown into the middle of this society, and he's got to find a kind of navigate his way through without ceding his will, is what he calls it, but without giving up his convictions.
Okay.
And so kind of everybody wants to use him because he's uniquely talented in a lot of ways, and it's hard to know who's the bad guy and who's the good guy in their wanting to use this young guy. But man, it brings like Harry, it's like Hogwarts and Hunger Games comes together in a lot of ways. So it actually takes place at a school, and like,
what's the name of the series again?
It's called the Hierarchy series.
The Hierarchy series.
Yeah. The reason it's called Hierarchy is because there's Will, this thing called Will is a really big part of the story, and there's levels to the hierarchy in society. So people like the lowest rung are called Octavi, they're level 8, and they have given their will, which in the book kind of resembles like strength and intellect and power. They've given their will to the next level.
Okay.
And so like there's some people who have like the strength and intellect of like 100 people below them. And so this young boy refuses to cede
like
his will.
The guy at the top of the pageant. Have the strength, have the knowledge of everyone below
them.
It's
like a gut punch every time you use the word pageant. So yeah, I would say that's probably the best fiction I've read this year.
Okay, Hierarchy series. Thanks so much, Jason, for that question. As always, if you've got questions for us for the mailbag episode, we're always looking. You can certainly reply on social media, but we have an email address. You can email us at mailbag@ftc.co. mailbag@ftc.co. Don't forget to leave off the M. It's not a .com. It's .co.
That's right.
And as always, if you enjoy the podcast, dear listener, thank you for spending your time with us. Give us a good review, if you don't mind. Ross isn't here anymore. He was really the kind of hard-nosed guy on the reviews.
That will not be me.
And that's not you.
That's
and
not
it's
me.
Not really me either, but I'll just, if I could virtually twist your arm, we have not had a review since I think October.
Or that's maybe probably my
early
fault.
Early November. It's not your fault. It's because, you know, Ross, he was a taskmaster with those things. So I'm going to give you a guilt trip. Why are you enjoying this content like a freeloader without giving us a good review? So get on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you watch or listen to your favorite podcasts, and give us a good review. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church.